Let's get the hour rolling like we do on Tuesdays by checking in with our friend, a writer and critic and ridiculously enthusiastic walker, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How are you, sir?
I'm wonderful.
Because you walk a lot doesn't mean you're enthusiastic about it. All kinds of reasons to walk, right?
Absolutely. But I love walking, though you take it to a high that I have only dreamt about.
You come out there with me on one of my 35-mile ambles sometime, and you tell me how much you love it.
I'd be good till about the halfway point, and then I'm calling for help. But Well, we're here today, though, to talk about that witty fellow, that crazy jokester, Henry David Thoreau, whose 200th anniversary was celebrated this summer. But you want to talk about a different side of Thoreau.
Well, you say jokester. I think of him more as a japester. He had sort of an edge to his humor. He was one of those people who, you know how now we've inverted so many things where we've taken what once would have been negatives and turned them into virtues, like, you know, for instance, if you have passion and you like to get up and do things, well, that's negative because you're not very chill. It's easier to sit around and just do nothing. So Thoreau was someone who would have struggled a bit with that in this age because he had subsuming passions, really. And, of course, one of the famous ones is the time he spent in the woods in Walden and walking. If you've been to Walden and walked back into Concord from the pond, you know that it's only about 20-minute walk, so it's not that far. But he did catch his death basically at age 44, going out into the woods one night in a rainstorm because he just had to count the growth rings on a tree. We've all been there, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Interesting too. I was reading some of the commentary, and not everybody embraced what he did during the time. And Robert Louis Stevenson, who referred to his work as unmanly effeminacy and womanish solitude. Wow.
You see that a lot. Like, for instance, when Fitzgerald wrote the crack-up essays where he kind of bared his soul, someone like Hemingway came in to get a boot in by saying basically he was effeminate. That was kind of the notion for a long time, that if you were someone who had the courage to risk vulnerability and you were a male, that was somehow just unmanful of you. And Thoreau was someone who didn't stand on any ceremony whatsoever. He was, I almost think of him as like, you could have an indoor writer, say. And I don't mean like you're inside, but it's more about pretension and the fineries, more like doilies and biscotti and things like that. Like I saw in a literary journal, and this is, you see this a lot in MFA fiction. I think that's why people don't really read that much anymore, but I saw a sentence that went, he worked to liberate her breast from the restraining order imposed by a particularly officious brassiere. Now, if you wrote that and said that to your friends, they'd be like, oh man, Colin's lost the plot. This is really unfortunate. We should intervene. Whereas Thoreau, he wouldn't have written that way. He was what I think of as an outside writer, which doesn't mean that he just like romped about and was in the farce. I mean that he wrote, like, of the loam of life. He really got his hands dirty in that experience. Montaigne was another writer that way, and I think that's why they were both great journal writers, really.
And so how did Thoreau's journals differ from some of his other writings?
Walden, you would know, was, of course, like a book that he published, and then he worked to have it republished later in his life, near the end of his life. He had uncollected writings that he was trying to get into a book form, like his main writings from your area, Cape Cod writings. But I think he foremost thought of himself as a diarist. And that really was what he tended to most days throughout the bulk of his art-making life, really. And his entries, they're just wonderfully insightful into a kind of passionate, zealous living that we certainly don't see now, but it's not like we ever saw a ton of it. Like, this is one entry from when he was 33, and he writes, in literature, it is only the wild that attracts us. Dullness is only another name for tameness. It is the untamed, uncivilized, free, and wild thinking in Hamlet, in the Iliad, and in all the scriptures and mythologies that delights us. Not learned in the schools, not refined and polished by art. A truly good book is something as wildly natural and primitive, mysterious and marvelous, ambrosial and fertile as a fungus or a lichen. And I think, again, we see this tendency right now towards safety. You see that sort of third-person narrative drone voice in so much writing. Or you see stories bereft of any plot, any characterization, any development, any intimacy between characters, or even a character just with him or herself. So that's what he means by wildness. He doesn't mean like, oh, wow, look, your prose is out of control. You don't use punctuation. You're just like some beat poet or something like that. He's talking about the very gut of life, that kind of like life loam, as I think of it, your hands dirty in the soil.
And he was also not afraid, although people think of him for his work as a naturalist, but he got very political with civil disobedience, was a strong abolitionist as well. And for some reason, I feel like people have neglected or forgotten that aspect of his writing and of his belief system.
He could be relentlessly obdurate. I mean, when he had some like belief, something that he thought he was on the right side of, he spent a night in jail, and he was basically only sprung from jail because a relative paid a fine that he wasn't going to pay. And he writes in the journals about basically he'll be saying, oh, yeah, I've been out huckleberrying all day today. It was a great time. I saw this like little bear, hung out with it. I'll have to go to a party with these morons tonight. He was not someone who... So he was one of those people there. I think we trust this kind of person more in life. Like if we look at our own lives where they don't have like a ton of acquaintances, you're always suspicious of that person. You suspect that there's little that's real about them. Thoreau was the kind of person who would have very close friends, but a small group of those close friends. And he didn't really care if he alienated you because you didn't have truck with what he stood for. Now, you could have disagreed with him, and that wouldn't have bothered him that much because he would have respected you for holding to your principles. Like, he loved the proper dust-up rhetorically. But if he thought you were soft or you were someone who sort of just bent the knee and were fake, he wasn't keen on that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. What would you recommend for people who have maybe only been exposed to Walden? Where would be a good place to start exploring Henry David Thoreau to capture more of him?
His writings on Cape Cod are as of the place as the driftwood you'll find washed up on the beach. I would start with those. And it's like we're at the time of the year, too, where I think people are kind of getting their last strolls until they settle in inside for the season. So to have a beach walk after reading, and it doesn't have to be like you're on Cape Cod, one beach will do as well as any other with an ocean close by. I would say that that's a good one. In fact, with the exception of maybe the Outermost House, I don't know that there's a better work of Cape Cod nonfiction out there, basically. So that would be a good start. Everyone knows Walden, but it's funny because I go to Concord a lot, and Walden has kind of become this, I don't know, hippie, drippy type of place where you get your... you know, your guitar, and you sing some, like, ode to your hipsterdom. And I think during the summer and spring, it's kind of, like, overrun with that sort of element. But to go there by yourself in the winter is a wonderful thing. I went there last winter, and it's a New England sort of thing. I had my Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and I stumbled on the ice on that side. If people have been there, you know that on the side where the train tracks are, it slopes very quickly from the shore to like 20 feet deep. And I almost went in, but I held that coffee aloft and I stopped my roll, which seemed like kind of, I don't know, I think Thoreau would be a Dunkin' Donuts guy.
I like that. That reminds me, many years ago, teaching high school, and it was a wintry day, a little bit slick, and I was walking into school early in the morning, and I had my little briefcase in one hand and a Dunkin' Donuts coffee in the other, and I hit a patch of ice and I went airborne. And in that moment where time stands still, I thought about my options and reached for the coffee and caught it as I landed on my rear end on the ice, but didn't spill a bit of coffee. Felt pretty good about myself. I got up, dusted off the snow, looked around, very happy that no one had seen me. And as I came in the building, a group of early arriving students came out in the hall and gave me a nice round of applause for my efforts.
Oh, you get it. See, it would have been an embarrassing death for me, so I'm glad that worked out. It's like, people often think of Thoreau as, especially the way he's kind of written about right now, is this, like, hothead, like this really belligerent guy that just wouldn't be worth the bother, like, if you knew him, and so he's kind of not worth the bother as a writer because he's such a first-person dominant writer, even when he's writing about things that he's describing, which could be like a third-person type of voice. But he kind of had this mind-body split going for him that is rare in the history of literature. When he was 35, he wrote, and I just think this is, takes a kind of sagacity that few of us will ever reach. He wrote, "I only know myself as a human entity, the scene, so to speak, of thoughts and affections, and am sensible of a certain doubleness by which I can stand as remote from myself as from another. However intense my experience, I am conscious of the presence and criticism of a part of me which, as it were, is not a part of me, but spectator, sharing no experience but taking note of it, and that is no more I than it is you. When the play, it may be the tragedy of life, is over, the spectator goes his way. It was a kind of fiction, a work of the imagination only, so far as he was concerned." Now, that is like writing of prose at the level of a Flaubert, a Proust, a Fitzgerald. You see it in some of Keats's late odes, some of Keats's letters. There's a musicality in there that dovetails with an awareness, a self-awareness that is Socratic, really. And he mixes in nature, because with Thoreau, he's never far from nature, because he realizes that man is basically a wilderness unto himself as well.
Maybe you've heard it. If you ever get a chance, I think you can find it online. Listen to our friend, Maine singer-songwriter David Mallett, did a wonderful project a few years ago called The Fable True. And it's a combination of Thoreau's words from the Maine woods, narration and instrumental music by David. And it's really a wonderful presentation.
Yeah, and I think Maine woods is another fine work to always turn to. It's almost like those 60s bands that have like that one hit, right? Or you think of them as having like this one hit, like the Left Bank, like Walk Away Renee, and you think, okay, well, that has to be their only one. It's just so good. It outshines everything else. And then you can overlook, oh, they have this really great debut album. We don't hear that. And I think that happens almost where Walden is a little bit of a disservice to Thoreau's overall output. You see it with Fitzgerald too, like with Gatsby. How many people do you know? I'm sure you have students and returning students who'll say, like, oh, Gatsby was my favorite book. And you say to them, what did you think about Tender as the Night? They'll say, well, what are you talking about? I've never heard of that. And you think, like, but you love this so much by this person, you didn't check out anything else they did. And I think that happens so much with Walden. So if you only know Walden, check out Maine woods, check out the Cape Cod book. But really, spend some time with the journals more than anything, because we talk now how this is a short attention span era. You can go to the journals. They are bite-sized, and you can be like, oh, I can really connect with this guy. He does not like that dude he met at this party, and he's just blowing off humanity for 4 hours and romping about in the woods. I'm going to romp about in the woods. It's a good model for that.
Colin Fleming joining us here on Downtown. And next week, looking forward to this, we'll talk about the Peanuts Thanksgiving special, which is a little bit different than most of the average Charlie Brown animated specials.
Well, the Peanuts venture into the 70s soul era. So they've ditched the voice actors of the 1960s specials, which were, I think, like a large reason why those specials work as well as they do. You think about Charlie Brown, even though the guy who played him turned out to be like a felon later in life, and Linus. And his speech, right, at the Christmas episode.
Yeah.
But in the Thanksgiving episode, we have a whole new schema for Charlie and his friends. And we have Woodstock is one nasty little cannibal of a bird.
All coming up next Tuesday. We're looking forward to it. Thank you, Colin.
All right, thank you.
That's Colin Fleming. Hear him every Tuesday here on Downtown and read his works but everywhere. Tremendous writer, and he's everywhere. You name it, Sports Illustrated, Slate, Daily Beast, all over the place. Great stuff from Colin Fleming. So happy to have him be a part of the show every Tuesday afternoon.